Hello, listeners. Welcome to the fourth episode of The Blue Radio. Thank you for being with us up to now. So far, we have heard three stories from three different survivors. They have shared with us their childhood experiences, how they thought their childhood adversity has impacted them as an adult, and their journey of healing. Today, I will be talking to Dr. Jennifer Silvers about the impacts of child abuse on development and on adulthood, alongside some other facts that she will be sharing with us. Dr. Silvers is a professor of psychology at University of California, Los Angeles. Let's dive in.
I'm Dr. Jen Silvers. I am an assistant professor at UCLA in the Department of Psychology, where I study how children and adolescents' experiences shape brain development, particularly as it pertains to social and emotional development. So a lot of what my lab studies is how children who have adverse experiences early in development, how that impacts their subsequent mental and physical health, as well as their brain development and emotional well-being.
Can you describe what you define as child abuse, and what are some points you would like to highlight?
So in talking about child abuse, I think it's helpful to take a step back and to think about child abuse under a broader umbrella of childhood adversity, which can include a variety of experiences ranging from abuse, neglect, other kinds of exposures to violence. Sometimes people will place extreme poverty under childhood adversity. There's a few things to think about when we talk about childhood adversity. One is that we're not just talking about having a tough time, not getting the toy you want as a kid, not talking about starting at a new school where you have to make friends. Those things might be challenging in the moment, but they're still within the bounds of something we would expect a typical child to be able to cope with pretty readily. When we talk about childhood adversity, we're talking about experiences that would require a typical child to really have to make significant adaptations to be able to kind of deal with the situation. And the situation might actually exceed their capacity to cope. So that's one thing that's helpful just to think about is the definition of adversity. Another thing that's helpful to think about is how common childhood adversity it's probably the normative experience for children to have some exposure to adversity in their lives. But the type of adversity that they experience is going to be highly variable. And notably, a lot of kids who experience one kind of adversity or who experience it one time, they often are more likely to experience it again. So it's not evenly spread across the population. There's some kids who get kind of a number of unlucky cards dealt to them, whether that's experiencing a high level of poverty, in addition to experiencing abuse, for example, or neglect. Another thing to know about childhood adversity is it's the single biggest preventable cause of mental illness. When I say that, I don't just mean mental illness in childhood, but also in adulthood. It's been estimated that childhood adversity can accounts for approximately a third of all adult cases of mental illness, suggesting that the experiences that we have in childhood not only have a disproportionate effect on our well-being in childhood, but that they can stick with us over time. At the same time that we know it's a significant risk factor for mental illness, one of the challenging things about trying to understand childhood adversity and abuse in particular for the purposes of this podcast is that different people respond in incredibly different ways to the same experience. You can have two kids who experience the exact same abuse, and they can have really different mental health trajectories afterwards. That might be because of differences that they were born with and just how their brain was wired, how their nervous systems more broadly were wired, how their stress physiology was wired. And it also can be because of other factors in their lives. For example, if one kid had a close friend for many years who was there to support them despite them experiencing abuse, that's a big protective factor. And if the other child did not, that's a significant risk factor as well. So there's a number of different biological as well as broader social and contextual factors that are going to impact whether a given person goes on to develop significant challenges after experiencing abuse. So when we think about something like child abuse, it's important to think about it very, to be very clear about whether we're talking about abuse for a single individual or at a more societal level. At a societal level, there are tremendous public health as well as ethical reasons that we all should care about reducing the prevalence of child abuse. When we talk about a single individual, it's very hard to predict with one in one person what their experience will be just based on what's happened to them because of all these complex factors that go into their experience in the moment as well as over time with abuse. So that's why it's really important to hear from individuals about what their experience is, but also to make policy and sort of treatment decisions by looking at aggregate data across many, many people.
Survivors often mention that their abuse went unnoticed when they were a child. What are some noticeable traits in victims of child abuse?
This is actually something that I've been thinking a lot about because it's become really challenging during COVID specifically. There's a lot of reasons to believe that rates of child abuse have increased dramatically during COVID. That's because there's a set of pretty reliable factors that increase the likelihood of abuse to occur, including economic strife, so parents losing their jobs. When adults experience a high degree of stress, they're more likely to abuse their children. When they don't have access to childcare, basically if you can never get a break, you're more likely to abuse your children. And all these things are happening during COVID when folks are forced to be at home so often. Also, it means that in instances where it's not just the child being abused, but where it's the whole family potentially being abused by one member of the family, being in close proximity for long periods of time increases the risk of abuse. And then the second sort of reason that COVID is so dangerous is because your question about how do we know if someone's being abused, the best ways that the ways that abuse gets reported most often and is noted is really through schools. That's one of the most common ways, at least in the United States, and also through routine doctor's appointments with a pediatrician. And right now people are avoiding routine checkups because of fear of COVID. And with so many schools shut down, that's a major route by which typically people who we call mandatory reporters, there's a collection of different individuals and teachers and nurses, school nurses and so on are one of them who are required to report abuse if they suspect it. And right now kids are not having access to such individuals who might be able to make a good judgment about whether they think a child might be getting abused or who a child might confide in. But you know, child abuse, it's children and their parents, if it's parents who are abusing them or any other family member, often go to great lengths to hide it. Kids typically, even in an abusive situation, do not want to be taken away from their parents, and they don't want to get their parents in trouble, in part because they fear retribution from their parents and also because they fear their parents being taken away from them. So it's really challenging, and this is where often pediatricians and teachers and other folks who regularly interact with kids are so critical because they kind of have that more expert eye often for noticing when abuse might be happening.
And for those of us who are not in contact with children as teachers or doctors, how can we notice abuse?
I'd say that it's tricky because different kids respond in different ways. So without knowing a child well, it can be really hard to know. But if you notice any marked changes in someone's behavior in general or expressing sort of weird physical symptoms, kids often report feeling physically ill rather than emotionally ill in general. And so that's kind of one class of things that could indicate something. If kids are experiencing a lot of headaches or other sort of somatic complaints, that might be an indication. Any dramatic changes in behavior, whether it's a child or an adult, is usually a pretty good indicator something is going on. I think also often kids trying to avoid having interactions between, for example, if it's one of their parents abusing them and other individuals, that's often a sign that something might be going on. We know that one of the best sources of resilience that a person can have when encountering abuse or stress is just to feel supported by other individuals, whether that's a mentor, a friend, really just expressing concern for someone's well-being and just showing an interest in their life and reliably being there are really important factors.
What do the findings in your field of research suggest about the impact of child abuse on development?
There's a lot of research that's been conducted for really a couple decades now, starting in animal research and now also using human brain imaging, showing that experiencing different kinds of adversity in childhood has lasting impacts on brain development. So with animal research, the most common ways this is done is by experimenters changing a kid's experiences or changing a mouse's experiences, for example. So some of the first work on this was actually depriving monkeys of access to a mother, which is turns out to be an extremely stressful experience for young monkeys and causes long-term disruptions in brain development as well as associated social and emotional behaviors. A lack of normal social interactions, really just like being bad at interacting with peers. They tend to show inappropriate ways of trying to like soothe themselves when they're stressed out. So you'll see them like little monkeys who haven't had access to normative, like sort of normal caregiving will rock themselves in a corner as a way of trying to calm themselves down. And they just kind of act inappropriate with their peers. They'll kind of like get up in their face and then avoid them and just don't read the social cues right. And monkeys are very social, so it's pretty striking. There's also been a lot of work in rats and mice showing that you see differences in the development of memory as a result of experiencing stress. You see differences in anxiety-like behaviors as a result of experiencing either abuse from an abusive mother. There's ways that researchers can make animal mothers become more abusive or likely to be abusive, as well as by just taking a mother away for periods of time throughout for example, a rat pup's early upbringing. And you see lasting influences on memory, emotional behavior, social behavior, all sorts of things. And we have pretty compelling evidence in humans also that similar kinds of experiences in children can have very lasting and powerful consequences. Not for all kids, each kid responds differently to the same experience, but on average, children who have experienced a high degree of abuse or neglect are more likely to have a range of different kinds of difficulties.
How does the adversity children experience impact them in their adulthood? In other words, does this experience set them apart from non-abused peers?
Like, you know, when you look on average at individuals who experienced abuse, you see differences from individuals who did not experience abuse. But there's a lot of overlap in those two groups. So there's going to be a lot of kids who are abused. Let's say like the top, you could say like there's 30% of kids who are abused who will look as though they're sort of mentally, in terms of mental health, better off or the same as children who were not abused. I'm making up numbers, but just to illustrate my point, it's you can't predict with any one child, but on average, the average child who was abused is going to be at a much greater risk for developing mental health problems, ranging from anxiety to depression to substance use, than the average child who was not abused. There's going to be some who are remarkably resilient and go on to be incredibly successful, just as though there's some children who really experience zero adversity growing up, who struggle tremendously with mental health, because it's a lot of different factors that come together to predict a given person's outcomes. But on average, as I mentioned in the beginning, exposure to childhood adversity, it accounts for about a third of all adult mental illness. So that means if we could eradicate child abuse, neglect, and other negative experiences, we could immediately cut the world's incidence of mental health problems by a third. So it's a pretty big factor. Your question about what happens if you've experienced abuse, how does that impact your likelihood of responding to subsequent abuse? On average, if you experience multiple instances of abuse, or if you experience abuse and then multiple other stressors later in life, usually you see your risk of mental health problems increasing a lot. So it seems as though it makes you more sensitive to subsequent stressors. The exception to that is that sometimes there's a little bit of research, at least in animal research, looking at rats, for example, that rats that experience a little bit of stress in childhood might be more robust and resilient to stress later on. So maybe experiencing some stress in childhood is not a terrible thing, but what we would typically classify as abuse is usually not going to make somebody stronger against subsequent stressors. But there's variability. Every individual child is going to be different, but that's on average. If you've experienced abuse, it's going to put you at a greater risk for developing mental health problems in response to further stressors.
Now, as adults who have grown to become more prone to mental health problems on average, how do you suggest survivors can deal with their trauma?
So there's a lot of really good treatment options that exist for individuals who experienced trauma, for example. So we often put this under sort of a broader category of trauma-informed care when we think about the health professions in general for how we deal with people who've experienced trauma. But there's one particular therapy that I've seen used with some success called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. From my read of the literature, it seems to be successful. But it really depends on what an individual is struggling with. If they're dealing with anxiety versus if they're dealing with difficulties with attention, it's something that they would really want to work with a therapist. And that would be, I think, the first step is to see a skilled therapist with expertise in dealing with trauma or dealing with experiences of abuse. There's going to be plenty of adults who really don't have anything to deal with because it didn't impact them very much for whatever reason. But there's going to be some for whom this is really just a lifelong, almost chronic health condition that they just have to work with and manage. So it might be that psychotherapy is super effective. It might be that taking medication is really effective. It's something that they would need to work with a mental health, with a counselor or with a psychologist or a psychiatrist if they require treatment. Beyond the specific sort of treatment route, there's a lot of factors that we know are protective for human mental health in general. So feeling that you make a contribution to the world is really important. So that might be creating a podcast, for example, on a topic that's important to you. It might be volunteering. It might be doing something to help, for example, kids who you know have experienced abuse, being a mentor for a foster child, for example. We know that having social connection is hugely important. So having good relationships that leave you feeling supported in them, that's really important. I think there's lots of other things that we can do in our everyday lives that just generally are likely to make somebody feel healthier. But those are some of the big ones.
And as we approach the end of this episode, are there any points you would like to add?
Child abuse is a public health concern. If there's something that we want to do to improve our society as a whole, we need to invest in both reducing the likelihood of child abuse ever occurring by preventing it. And the best way to do that is to support parents, to give parents access to healthcare, quality education for their children, childcare, the resources they need to be able to take care of their kids, and also things like social support and parenting classes are really, really helpful for helping to reduce the likelihood of child abuse ever occurring. We also need really robust structures in place to support children who have experienced abuse, because early intervention is one of the best ways of preventing long-term mental and physical health consequences associated with abuse. So I think from one thing I'd say is from a public health perspective, it's so critical that we invest in this. The other thing I just want to reiterate is that whenever we talk about something like abuse, really any other risk factor, it's just one ingredient in many for predicting a single individual person's life trajectory. So if somebody experienced abuse, they shouldn't feel doomed. They shouldn't feel that they can't live a healthy and happy life. They should know that it puts them at risk for having certain kinds of challenges, just like having genetic risk factors for cancer. But it's just something that they need to know. It's a part of them, but it's not all of them. And it's something that they can take steps to improve their life on with effective treatments and involving therapy medication, whatever it is that they need.
I think Dr. Silvers emphasized some great points. What I especially liked was debunking the myth that abuse makes you stronger. Actually, as she pointed out, on average, abuse makes you more prone to mental health problems later in life. Also, it is important to note that survivors respond to childhood abuse in different ways, so there is no unified label or conclusion we can talk about in regards to child abuse survivors. The most important thing we can do for them is to be there and to be good listeners. With that, I will end this episode. Thank you for listening.